I'm Dale Cugat with Olam International. We're the second largest cotton trader in the world. We have businesses in 65 countries. We actually represent 25 different countries. That's sort of the sales pitch on my company. I want to tell you today, I am speaking from my own personal opinion. This is not Olam's perspective. This is my perspective. And that's actually how I operate inside the company itself, that I'm actually sort of an internal consultant. So I was asked to talk about China. I hope you all brought food and drink because we're going to be here about 6 days to try to cover all these topics. But I really kind of want to touch on and get people to think outside the box on China and to kind of think of more outside the box on cotton. And I want to tell everybody I'm a very optimistic person at heart. I believe China will import, but I think we need to kind of calm down on what we think they might be doing as we go into the phase one program. Kind of start with China reserve policy. I kind of want to talk on, you know, after their humongous purchases back in 13-14, they kind of came back into the market and started purchasing this year. We see them coming in the 19-20 with a new program. Current stocks in the reserve, and I'm sorry guys, I'm kind of talking tons because I've been working a lot with China lately, but it's about 1.75 million tons, about 8 million bales sitting in the reserve. And I kind of want to go in to say, is that a good number or not? Well, first of all, China creates a reserve policy for this year, and they basically said, we're only going to purchase about 50,000 tons in this program. And with that, they're also looking at, they got very strategic on what they're actually purchasing on quality-wise. They actually put a time limit. They're only going to buy between December 2nd and March 31st. They actually set their price limits based off international prices. So it's kind of interesting as you go in this and you look at what they've been buying, they stopped buying. In the last 2 weeks, they had bought nothing. As international prices have gone up and local prices have gone up, they're no longer purchasing for the reserve. Right now, they've only purchased approximately about 37,000 tons in their six-week period of purchasing. They only have another 2 months of purchasing to hit that limit. So jumping real quick, everybody says, well, China needs to buy for the reserve. We've been hearing that for months now. Now that they've released all this cotton, China needs to buy from the reserve. I would argue to differ. They do not need to buy any more cotton for their reserve. Basically, their current level is still higher than their historical average level that they had prior to them stockpiling in that 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 period. So they have plenty of cotton in the reserve, once again, at about 8 million bales or about 10% of their total consumption. But more importantly, in the 13-14 period, they purchased 95% of the crop. What happened there, and I made this argument over and over again, soon as they stopped purchasing the crop and releasing stock, the traders came in and started building stock. So now you have this humongous free stock inside China. Highest level ever. And as you can see, it's approaching, I don't know, 12 million tons. I'm sorry, 8 million tons. But I will note that, remember, China is still a communist country. Those free stocks are not really always free. I've said at many of times in a textile mill, and they'll tell me, I have 12 months of stock, but the Chinese government just announced I can only have six. So they have to relinquish those six stocks into the marketplace very quickly, otherwise take the wrath of the government. So in essence, free stocks, I'll let you make that determination. At the same time, the rest of the world said, wait a minute, the last time China got in a buying program, we couldn't access imports either because they went out and bought international cotton as well. So what we've seen over the last 3 years, 4 years, is that the international markets, especially the consuming and producing markets, your Turkey, your Mexico, Pakistan, India, they've increased their production and their consumption, but they've also increased the stocks that they're holding so they don't get caught with China holding all the cotton again. So now we have large stocks, not just in China, but also around the world. Then we actually look inside China. One of the things I like to do is I pulled this up, and this is basically looking at the net movement within a given year. The yellow line is the mill use. So historically, China is going to import. They almost have to because their their mill use consistently exceeds their production. And in this case, you can see the net, basically it's a net reserve release, what they purchase and what they release on a given year, plus the net crop that they produce and the net imports. They're going to continue importing. The question is, at what level? And one of the things I would question, if you look at the last 5 years, they've consistently have bought above what they consumed. My question is, as I look at 1920, does that number need to be adjusted down? Do they need to increase more imports? Or are we going to actually see a deficit year in their supply versus what they're going to consume? And then the one thing that we all need to be cautious of is prices. One of the things that we've seen, and John did a very good example of this, is we look at world prices, China prices, and you better be looking at fiber prices, because China has a fiber policy. All of us think that they have a cotton policy. They have a fiber policy. So one of the things we've witnessed, and I'm sorry, I think this is only updated through the end of January, but even so, it gives you a good indication. You see, look, A index, Far East, basically landed China. It's hovering between 78 and 80 cents, and we've been there for a while. Inside China, prices around 82 to 84 cents. Polyester prices, 38 to 40 cents. 50% of what cotton prices inside China. And I'm not going to get into the decision-making process from a retailer, but that makes a big decision because historically polyester prices volatility is a lot lower than cotton prices. And I'm flying through these things, and I apologize, but I'm trying to cover a lot of points at one time. But one of the things that an old mentor once told me is, once cotton loses share, it never regains share. But part of what's happened is cotton, and I'm very positive about this, is cotton has a consistent annually growth of about 2%, 2.25% growth rate over the last 30 years. We're going to continue that cotton growth rate. I do believe in that. However, polyester has been growing at 4 to 6%. So yes, we're going to consistently lose share to cotton. However, one of the things that I've often, when I do this presentation, we'll discuss with people, one of the biggest things that a lot of us in the cotton market didn't think about back in 2000, when we joined, and that kind of goes back when we joined the WTO and China got involved, China was just starting their polyester production and their polyester capacity. One of the things I like showing this chart is two things. And this is world polyester, but just so you kind of get a feel for it, polyester staple fiber kind of goes up and plateaus. Why do we like polyester staple fiber? Because you can blend cotton with it. Have you ever tried blending in a filament? Basically, a polyester filament is basically keeping the yarn, and you don't chop it up into staple. You keep it yarn, so it doesn't get chopped up. They save a lot of money, a lot of energy, and it continues to grow. It's a very cost savings for China, and they continue to expand in that arena. So when you go inside China, you can actually see China's polyester capacity increased by more than five times between 2000 and 2020. Rest of the world did not even double, like 50%, 60%. Basically, all the growth in the world when it came to polyester occurred inside China. Even to a point where, once again, if you look at China polyester operating rates, historically their operating rates, and I've put this from 0 to 100, but you couldn't get the dynamics, but historically they've averaged between 70 and 80%. Right now they're up around 85, 88%. But I think a very interesting story is just between the months of February and March, they basically produced half of the world cotton crop in a three-month, four-month period just on implementing and increasing their capacity usage, not increasing new capacity, just on implying and incorporating new capacity of approximately 12.5 million tons, which the world crop is 25 million tons. So, I mean, that's pretty massive to see what China can do just in a matter of a couple months and filling demand, as John was saying, which has been fairly flat. And this kind of goes back to my story a while ago about stocks to use. Historically, most people understand the stocks to use ratio, but really what you're trying to do is you're trying to get from a July period, which is usually the marketing season, until the new crop becomes available. The United States, on average, you need about a 25% stocks to use ratio. Globally, you need a little bit more because you got to trade more in the trade and movement of cotton. So you need about a 35-40%. But look at this. You have China at 87% stocks-to-use ratio. You have the world at a 67% stocks-to-use ratio. On average, it should be around 40-45%. And then, look, once again, one of the things that a lot of us have been watching is that non-China ratio, as they continue to try to build stocks, mainly to build stability into their market. I put this slide in, and I did not get the data that I wanted. I worked with my China team. But one of the things I wanted to highlight is, in the United States, when we talk about the farm bill, and I was glad to hear Bart talk about it, but in essence, when you really get down to it, how many farmers makes up our population in the United States, and even rural? Farmers are less than 1%. I think it's less than 0.5%. And then you get into the rural population, it might be 10-15%. In China, over 40% of their population is rural. In the United States, just put it in perspective, we're talking 300 million. We're talking 1.4 billion. So when we talk about the cotton program cost them X, it didn't matter when they were storing all that stock, because they were more concerned about how do they manage that 40% population and keep them happy out in the far west area. Because for a majority of us, we only see what China publishes, and most of that's going to be in the urban areas out on the east and on the ocean side. Until you travel out in that area, which I have many times, it's very interesting to see the very dynamics and the difference of what's published in press and what actually is out there. So one of the things that China does is, just like we do, they have an ag policy or ag bill they put out. They come out and their whole goal is to try to close the gap between urban and rural. And I'm going to read this just to make, because one of the things they've noticed is the actual slipping of income in the migrant workers between 2012 and 2018. But the average farmer or the average worker only makes about $2,067 annually, versus internal in the cities or the populated area, about $5,500. But it's interesting, if you read the bottom, the last line of that, 90% of the migrant or the rural income comes from migrant workers sending money back to the rural areas. And it's very much the case. People will live way below their means, and they're sending money, like in the military, but they send it back out to their families. And it's a very common thing. Another thing I found interesting, that in the United States, on average, our farms feed 256 plus people. In China, it's 7, plus their own family. That's pretty dynamic when you think how many people are involved. Another thing, when I talk about China's going to import, don't get me wrong, but don't get too aggressive. Look at their fixed asset investments. Now, you go back and you could probably go back to 2000, and they were consistently at 35-40%. Then all of a sudden in 2010, 2011, they dropped to about 10-15 year-over-year growth. We actually saw our first year-over-year negative decline back in May and June of this year. So it's not a priority. Their investments are going other places. It's not being invested inside China, as we all know. We hear these stories. So where is it going? Well, I'll get to that in a minute. Wrong slide, but one of the things that China has done is, and once again, let's think outside of cotton and the textile industry, why do they want to get away from spinning in China? It's the most polluting part of the whole supply chain. Because in the sustainability side, that's usually what they're going to tell you. You have water, yeah, but they've got to fuel those spinning mills by coal plants. So in 2008, 9, 10, we watched them wipe out more than 3,000 spinning mills in South China. Now they're trying to wipe out every spinning mill under 300 spindles across all of China, and really focus on now in expanding out in the Xinjiang where their cotton production is. And mainly a lot of it, my personal humble opinion, is because they're trying to move the pollution or eliminate the pollution part of the supply chain. Now, the interesting thing is, when you go back and you look at all the new spinning plants, if you put in a new spinning plant, you didn't just put in a new spinning plant. You actually had to put in a new power plant next to your spinning plant. And it had to be state of the art. And it couldn't be coal. It had to be wind. It had to be all these other aspects. So in essence, they want the new technology. But on the other side of it is, they're not really keen to create the spinning inside China, except out in the Xinjiang area, which you actually can see here. They've almost more than, over a six-year period, tripled the number of spindles out in Xinjiang. If we look at the actual output, the number of textile mills have doubled in the last 2 years. And I'm sorry, these are National Bureau of Statistics out of China data, which I'm publishing those as they are stated. We actually see output more than double out in Xinjiang. And remember, this is where most of the cotton inside China is being produced. But however, how many people understand China's geography? It would be like putting all of our textile industry out in Montana and having to move everything to Montana. So if they ever have a crop failure, the question is, how do we ever get yarn out there? I mean, it would be the most inefficient way to get out there. However, since they have this consistent crop out there, and basically it's a desert crop where they can actually irrigate very well, and how are they irrigating it? They're irrigating off of glacier water that should supply them the next 20, 25 years. Then the question becomes, what happens? But in essence, one of the things, and this is where I come back and say, they're really trying to eliminate all these small spindle operations and move poorly equipped processing plants out of that area. One of the other things that we've consistently seen is China is actually trying to refocus what they produce inside China. Xinjiang has become the cotton hub for China, but they do not really want cotton grown in the interior. They want more food products, corn, wheat, those kind of products. So they've really focused on pulling cotton out to Xinjiang. And I'm sorry, I've meant to get that in dollars, but at the 18,601, it's consistently drawing acres in. As we can see, acres out there have consistently grown for cotton from about 1,000 or about 1 million hectares now to almost 2.5 million hectares. And it's very good yielding. So, and it's very consistent. Majority of it, more than 80%, is actually controlled by the military. So they maintain very good operations. They tie into their ginning operations. And now jumping back to where I was saying a while ago, then they don't want to spend inside China. So what did China say? China basically told all these textile mills, I'm going to give you some money. Go invest it yonder. So what they do? They create China and Vietnam has a great trade negotiations that allows yarn to flow in. So they invested heavily in Vietnam. They've been consistently heavily in Thailand. I did not put it in, but they're also consistently heavily in Korea and several other small markets. And basically, the yarn then just flows right back into China once it's produced. And as you can see here, I put this China yarn imports and tariffs mainly to show, if you look at it, the ones who actually have tariffs, majority of them are also major producers and consumers of cotton, that being India, Pakistan, Uzbekistan, and the U.S. I'm not quite sure why they have it on Russia, but Russia doesn't move that much yarn, so it doesn't really matter. But on the other side of it is, China's total fabric production through this whole period, the last 10 years, have been fairly consistently growing, especially for cotton. So either they had domestic cotton or reserve cotton that came in, or they imported yarn. And what they would do is they couldn't get cotton in the textile. When I say this, when the textile mills could not get cotton in, then they brought in yarn. And if we go back to that 2000 period and we look at why all these textile mills came about, most of those textile mills that were created, they were not just textile mills. These textile mills were completely vertically integrated textile mills. So they could bring in yarn into their processing facilities, and it could be cotton or polyester, local yarn or international yarn. So what we've seen is the annual textile and garment exports have basically risen very fast. And a lot of us, that's what we got really caught up in the 2000s to 2010, this fast growth. But what we also have seen is it flatlined. One of the things that I try to stress to my company and the people I talk to, cotton is still important to China, but not at the same level it was back in 2000 or 2010. If you look here, back in 2000, basically it was like 22 to 23% of the total exports were revolved around textiles. Today, that number is closer to 10 to 10-11%, if not lower. So it doesn't have the same glamour. One of the things that China really tried to do internally, and they've done a fairly good job, is basically just increase domestic consumption of their own cotton products and even their international cotton products that came in. And only recently have we seen the reduction of domestic, the exports of their products actually twist and actually start rising again. But their domestic consumption continuously has risen. And I'm still trying to figure that one out myself, if that's more of a function of the Xinjiang coming involved in the subsidies in Xinjiang and how that domestic consumption in the 18-19 period is evolving. Jumping real quick to what John was pointing out, the global economy is flat. And I remember Barry Worsham with Cotton Incorporated, and glad John's here, his comment always, if the economy is not growing more than 1.75%, 2%, you don't get cotton retail demand growth. It's fairly flat. You don't have enough income to go out and buy a bunch of extra products for fashion purposes. Now, you might buy that pair of jeans that you have to have or that shirt you have to have, but you're not buying multiple shirts because you have extra income. Also, if you look at from China garment exports, heavily, three markets, U.S., well, I say three, European Union and Japan, pretty much make up 60% of that. And if you look at the developing countries, as John was saying, if it's flat, then why does China need to increase that demand for yarn or cotton itself? So how's the trade impacted us lately in this trade negotiations? Yes, we've lost share. We're down to about 18%, 19%. Interesting that I would point out, and this is just coming from the inside of knowing what's happening in trading houses, but a lot of the cancellations that's been popping up lately have been coming from China. A lot of those contracts were actually purchased almost a year ago when prices were at 76 and 78 cents. And if y'all could wipe out a year in your history and go back to that point, that was cheap because we just came from 96 cents. But guess what? When you're at 66 cents, 78 cents is very expensive. However, can we regain this share from Brazil? In a heartbeat. We still have some of the best quality cotton in the world, some of the most dynamic, best delivery processes that we can. If we get back in the market very competitive with Brazil, we'll regain our market share. That is not a problem. So kind of coming back to what my original statement is, once again, all these comments are my personal humble opinion. I do think China is going to import. As clearly it states, they almost have to with the mill use exceeding the crop. I just don't see that China needs to ramp up large stocks. And I would also come back to say, from a trader perspective, it's a one-year hallelujah and a five-year uh-oh. And basically when you go to that 13-14 period when they bought all those stocks, it was positive for us because guess what? They bought imports. They bought from the U.S. and everybody, we all saw it. However, what happened the next 5 years? China then had control over prices over the next 5 years because how they would release stocks or buy stocks or the perception they're going to release stocks or buy stocks would change the price dynamics and would change how we were going to grow and sell basically in the United States on our government programs because they would release and announce cotton based off the February-March period and all of a sudden you see these big changes. But then they would change it, you know, 6 months later, and you would not get the full impact. So with that noted, I'm very positive about phase one. And I do have one statement to say about phase one. And once again, this is my personal humble opinion is, how many of y'all actually know what is the total level that China has estimated they're going to purchase from the United States? Anybody want to take a guess on it? $54 billion. Anybody else? This is such a media thing, and I'm glad you said that. All the media has picked up on is agriculture because they're saying that China has to buy his products so that Trump can get his voting in the rural and urban areas. I would go back to you and tell you, make sure you read all of phase one. They're going to be buying 200 million plus products, agriculture and manufacturing goods. The details that we all know which is basically nothing. They have estimated, everybody in the industry and their press has estimated, and it's been stated this high number, but if we were to export, and John and I were talking about this, $40 billion a year agricultural products, we would be taking 50, 60% market share in almost every product line that we export to them, which is almost undoable. We would lose all of our other markets. So I would just caution not to get, I mean, I am optimistic about phase one, about them purchasing. But in essence, the one thing I would go back to say is, and I actually get presses, I mean, the newspapers out of China, which I highly recommend, read that along with our news presses. And one of the things they've consistently said is, we'll buy what market demands. You know, so we'll have to see how that plays out. I mean, I still think it's very positive that we are coming to the trade negotiations. And probably more importantly, from the intellectual property rights and all the other aspects of the trade negotiation, is very positive for us. But personally, as a trader, I would rather see phase one have more tariff reductions, open quotas, open up the market, and let us compete one-on-one inside China.